and welcome to Against the Law, the ancient history podcast that aims to separate fact from fiction when it comes to the ancient world. Today we're making a splash with the first of our trio of elemental episodes, and as you might have guessed, this episode is all about ancient water. So let me introduce you to the drippiest podcast crew. First up we have Xenia, who hates it when people muddy the water about ancient Romans. We're also joined by our ancient Greek boff Meg, who can lead a Trojan horse to water but can't make it drink. Barney's here to dismiss the myths that don't hold water about the ancient Near East. And I'm Flo. I'm the hoistest with the moistest, and I might be a bit wet behind the ears when it comes to knowledge about the ancient world, but I'll cross that bridge when I come to it as I learn with you, dear listener, all about ancient water. So yes, you're joining us for a very soggy episode of Against the Law today, and we have got a huge amount of information to get through, so we're going to try and keep it snappy or choppy like the sea.
Keep it snappy like a alligator who might live in a river, and choppy like the sea.
Absolutely. So we've talked a little bit before, haven't we, about sewers, Xenia, and I remember you telling me about the Great Cloaca, which is the word that we use for birds and other animals' orifices when they've only got one exit and entry point, right? I feel bad calling it that, but that's what the sewer is. And that's what the Romans had. They had one great sewage system called the Great Cloaca. So Xenia, tell us a bit more about sewage.
In ancient Rome itself, the great city, the eternal city, you've got the Cloaca Maxima, which means literally the biggest, the greatest sewer of them all. And it was pretty impressive because you see Rome had up to 11 aqueducts. That was at its peak, 11 aqueducts, all pumping water from various different like natural springs or rivers or mountains up to 50 miles away. And they transported this water into the city. That was just for the city's use alone. And obviously all that water flushes through its usage within the city. That could be for baths, that could be for public fountains, that could be for private use and public toilets, of course. And then it all goes, flushes through into the Cloaca Maxima, the great sewer. And then they weren't very good at, they didn't have like filtration plants or anything. So out it all goes, mostly into the Tiber River, not very pleasant, or flows even further out into the sea.
So Roman poos bobbing in the ocean.
Indeed.
Lovely. So presumably the word aqueduct, that sounds very not modern English.
No. Do you want to know the etymology of it?
Water pipe.
So it means leading water. So duco, ducere, is to lead. So it literally leads water. And I think when we think about aqueducts, we think of like the really famous ones, the kind of multi three-story bridges with loads of beautiful arches. And yep, that is part of an aqueduct, but that's the most impressive external part. Most of the time, they're actually just like pipes underground pumping water across. And they, you know what, Roman engineering for moving water around was honestly so impressive, because the key to all of it is simply gravity. Like, water flows downhill anyway, doesn't it? And they just kind of maximize that. So it was all about making sure the water was always flowing down in some form or another, even if that meant sort of artificially like channeling it through these aqueducts or through pipes or through I don't know, cisterns and channels and things like that. They were so, so great at moving water around using literally just gravity to their advantage.
On that note, Meg, this might be against the law. Is there such a thing as an Archimedes screw? And did Archimedes invent it? And was it used?
Yes, and yes.
Hooray!
Yeah, I think we spoke about this relatively recently on an episode. I can't for the life of me remember which one. But yeah, absolutely. Archimedes screw is real, was used, and actually I think was used up until some ridiculously recent time frame when they invented slightly better systems. But yeah, Archimedes screw is, there's a sort of reconstruction of it in one of the museums in Athens. And you just turn the thing and the water comes up and it's all very smooth and impressive. And yeah, that they had a kind of like relatively similar to the Romans in terms of, but not as good, basically, in water. Like the Greek water systems are like kind of Roman, but worse. because they're a bit earlier. But they're pretty good. They, again, had lots of drains, lots of sewers. They didn't have something as cool as the Cloaca Maxima, but they did have a big old drain in Athens that leads out of the Agora, which is the sort of, like, the Roman Forum. It's the Greek version of that, a sort of marketplace, meeting point, all of that. So they needed to collect a lot of water from the buildings there and also from the hills. So there's lots of hills in Athens. And not many rivers. So it's this slightly weird terrain. Well, there's not lots of hills in Athens itself, but hills around the kind of, there's like a basin and then lots of big hills around that. And then there are a couple of hills in Athens itself. So they had to get rid of all the rainwater that comes off into the hills and flows into Athens. And it was a bit swampy back in the day. So they had to get rid of all that water. So yeah, big old drain, a meter wide when it's in the Agora itself, which then flows out again into a river, which isn't very nice.
You could have really big poos if it's a meter wide.
Oh yeah, massive.
Barney, something about devices for pulling water up and out of rivers or water sources has reminded me of a vague memory of being at primary school and seeing an invention by Egyptians, which looks a bit, if I can describe it, a bit like a trebuchet. It's a clay pot and you dip it in the water and then hoist it up and out. Is that ringing any bells?
Yeah, that's a real Egyptian invention called a shadouf.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and it's a tool to help with irrigation. It's used in fields that have been irrigated with water from the Nile to move water from your little irrigation canal into your patch of field.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's just like a counterweighted lever arm, basically, and you stand at one end, dip the bucket down, and then rotate it and pour the water over your field.
With ease.
With ease, exactly. And over the years, they crop up so much in TV documentaries and in primary school curricula, but like they're just not a big thing in ancient Egypt.
Against the law.
Would it like be in the future people getting absolutely obsessed over crowbars, which are definitely a thing but isn't something that every modern person is like, oh, I use my crowbar every day?
I think a bit like that. Yeah, it's because I think they're a nice illustration of like how water is literally moved around rather than explaining how like digging an irrigation ditch works.
So will you tell us a little bit about irrigation in the ancient Near East then?
I'll go on then.
Yeah.
So irrigation is a really big thing across the ancient Near East, both in Mesopotamia and in Egypt, because these are both civilizations that were based around large rivers. So Egypt has the Nile and Mesopotamia has two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates, which we've talked quite a lot about before. And because these are both cultures that are sort of based inland for the most part, they don't have a coast to contend with or many very big lakes, you've got to use the rivers for your water. And there's not very much rainfall in either of them, and they're both sort of situated in quite barren desert landscapes. So rivers are your sort of lifeline. And what you do is, once you've got a big river running through your land, you just dig a little hole in the banks, and water will start to flow across the floodplain and into your fields. And so there you go. Your farms have now got a nice supply of water as long as the river keeps flowing and is flooding well.
Brilliant. I was just going to say, you've done a double whammy of two against the laws there. One, which is shadoofs definitely existed, but not as big of a deal as we might be made to think. And the second one is that the ancient Near East wasn't this sort of barren, dusty landscape that we often get depicted in TV and film about happenings in the ancient Near East, right? I mean, I feel like I'm not the only one who's seen like orange dust as the primary setting of anything that takes place in the ancient Near East.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think it's important to think of Egypt as sort of like a long oasis that follows the course of the Nile as it flows from south to north through the desert. So, you know, everything around the Nile would have been incredibly green. And then, yes, you know, the desert is still a big part of the landscape, but that is very much outside the realms of the culture itself. And then, yeah, Mesopotamia, you know, this is the Fertile Crescent. So that whole section between the Tigris and Euphrates River, which is, you know, broadly what we know today as modern Iraq, would have been, yeah, a lot more verdant and lush than it is now, as, you know, the rivers have changed course over the years and flow in different ways, and obviously farming's done differently, so it doesn't quite look the same these days. But yes, it would be a mistake to think of these civilizations as just desert. And I think it's important to identify how crucial water was to them. And that can be reflected in the deities as well. Egypt has a god for the flooding of the Nile called Hapi.
Hippo.
I don't think it's related to Hippo, but it is a cute, it's a cute name. We've done the etymology of hippopotamus before, haven't we? That's a Meg one.
River horse.
Because you've got that same potamos in Mesopotamia.
Land between two rivers, right?
Yeah, between the rivers. Hapi is blue and has a beard and a big round belly and drooping breasts, which are all sort of symbols of fertility. So, you know, Hapi is the god that represents this fecundity that comes with the Nile.
Non-binary idol.
Exactly. Yeah, I think having traits of both sexes might render Hapi something like intersex.
Oh, yeah.
If you wanted to get categorical about it.
He might have gynecomastia, which is the medical term for man boobs, which is totally legit and normal if you have man boobs, by the way. You're not weird.
Hmm. Or he might be a woman with a beard. I don't think we should try and pin down Hapi.
He might, well, they might have PCOS like I do. So I certainly have got drooping breasts and sometimes beard hair.
Is it you, Hapi?
I'm Hapi most of the time, yeah.
Oh.
Flo, I think you're going to be eaten today because we've already drawn out some good against the laws and an etymology, but I've got possibly the mother of examples for each of those as well. I've got like the biggest etymology I think I've had in a long time and the biggest against the law.
Oh, yes.
This is so exciting. On the against the law front, I actually think Xenia's already come in with a pretty good against the law that I was going to say as well about the aqueduct, which is that the image of the aqueduct is so different to the reality of the aqueduct. And in the course of researching this episode, I've become quite passionate about this. And I think we need some kind of like social justice movement for like, not all aqueducts look like this, like impossible aqueduct body image. If you are a channel with a pipe, you're also valid and beautiful, you know? So
not all aqueducts.
Exactly. Underground aqueducts also matter and deserve our love and respect.
Do you all have the pet peeve where people call viaducts aqueducts?
Yeah, but this has now replaced that.
Barney, earlier you said that the Fertile Crescent was verdant and lush, and I have been fixated ever since on the word lush because I've got some bath products from them, and bathing is my number one hobby. I want to talk about ancient bathing. I know that the Romans had bathhouses, and I know that they had hot and cold baths, but was bathing common in the rest of the ancient world? Meg, I'm going to start with you, I think.
Yeah, again, it's the real same narrative that I said earlier. Like, I feel like often I will be like, oh, the Greeks did this, and Xenia are like, oh yeah, the Romans did that too. But this is like completely the other way around. Like, the Greeks were not very good at any of this. They were doing it, but they are not the Romans when it comes to, they don't have these massive ornate bathhouses that like are a huge part of public life. But they did have baths, like public baths. Interestingly, bathhouses were originally outside of the city walls in Athens, at least, which I thought was an interesting little thing. And then they, at a certain point, sort of come inside the city walls, which maybe suggests that they became sort of more important in public life. And the other time that you would get baths being quite a big thing are as connected to gymnasiums. So gymnasiums are like obviously the space for exercise. And I think I've definitely done this one before, but that is from gymnos, which means naked because they exercise naked. So there would be baths attached to the gyms. The like post-gym shower and bath was like a really big thing. And they did actually have showers, apparently. There would be like pipes that bring water to a sort of a spout, and the spout is often shaped like an animal's head. So more like a fountain, really, but that you could bathe under. And there's some paintings that we have that I couldn't find any of the actual original vases. And they show these sort of showers with like, there's like a boar's head and the water's coming out of the boar's head or a panther's head. So that does sound like quite a nice shower, I think. But it would be cold water.
Oh, you had me up until the cold water bit.
Yeah.
Oh, I've got a historical fact to bring to the table that Xenia can verify or tell me I'm completely wrong.
Oh.
The city of Bath in the UK used to be called Aquae Sulis, which is about the goddess Minerva Sulis or Sulis Minerva.
Yes, Brilliant. So that's right. The city of Bath is named after, today it's named after the Roman baths. It's a reference to the Roman baths. But in Roman times, it was called Aquae Sulis, which literally means the waters of Sulis. And she was the local goddess, the local sort of water deity. So what the Romans loved to do was something called syncretism, which is where they create like parallels between local gods that they came across and their own gods. And that meant it was a two-way process. It meant that the people of the sort of newly conquered lands could feel like they were part of the Roman Empire because they shared these kind of parallel gods. But it also meant that Romans coming to these new lands, especially soldiers, would then feel like they could see something familiar in this new strange land as well. So you get that quite a lot up at Hadrian's Wall. There's a really popular god called Jupiter Dolichinus, and Dolichinus is like the local one, and that's paralleled with Jupiter, and you get loads of soldiers putting up dedications to that. Anyway, so in Bath, this is the local goddess is Sulis, and she's syncretized or paralleled with the Roman goddess Minerva, who was in turn syncretized with the Greek goddess Athena. Bath obviously has a wonderful natural hot spring, and that's what the Romans kind of channeled into the very, very famous bathhouse that now still stands.
So could you just go to the baths? Was it mixed gender? Could you go with your other half for a nice public bath?
Well, yeah, it was quite rare for people to have bathing systems at home, plumbing systems, because they were very expensive. And so it was much more common to go and bathe. When I say common, what I'm referring to is actually quite a specific time period when it was common. So they already had loads of these in Greece, but they came to Rome, as in the empire and also the city, relatively late. But by the end of the first century BC, there were 170 small baths in Rome. And by the end of the 5th century AD, there were over 800. So like when they did arrive, finally, when the Romans decided that it was a public good to get clean, it took off like wildfire. They it became a really big part of Roman culture. So they'd have this bathhouse running pretty much all the time. And what they would do is have usually different sittings for men and women. So men would go in a certain time of day and women would go at a different time of day. And that meant you didn't have to build separate facilities for men and women. There are some baths, like the big baths in Pompeii. They have separate facilities for men and women. Unfortunately, the women's facilities are smaller. Sexism in the ancient world. Anyway, but that's most of the time, men and women were able to use the same facilities, but at different times.
I am amazed how recently people were regularly using the baths in Bath for that. I mean, you can still swim in Bath, but Samuel Pepys took his wife there to get good air when she got ill, and they bathed together, which is quite sweet.
Oh, they were able to bathe together.
They were able to bathe together, which he was quite grateful for, because I gather she was quite stinky, but so would he have been. So he's a bit of a hypocrite, really. That's rather cool then. So you've got public baths, and I think you've got public fountains as well, you've told me before.
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, it's amazing, all of these public services. I mean, Rome had so many public services because it was all about, initially it was about like leading politicians showing their largesse. And then it was about emperors showing their largesse, like showing that they were serving the people. So you do get a lot of public facilities, toilets, fountains. And because of the lack of plumbing within houses themselves, public fountains were actually very, very important, especially for poor people who would just go and get their water if they needed water for cooking, for, you know, flushing down any like indoor toilet facilities that they had if they weren't using the public ones.
Transferable tattoos?
or just sort of keeping anything that they needed to do, use water for at home, they'd have to go and get a big bucket load or a big amphora load from the public fountains. And that was also supplied from the aqueduct, so that would come in, just pump clean water out into these big fountains. Sometimes they were just sort of bowls of water, with stuff being pumped into it. But sometimes they were super fancy and they had like spouts and they had water pumping, being pumped out of like little statues and things like that, especially in private homes as well. You get a lot of really cute statues. Like there's that famous one, can't remember where it is, of like a boy peeing and that's where the water comes out. But they'd have things like that as well in their private homes.
Isn't it so charming that a boy having a wee into a water source is like, we still have that now. I mean, I swear I've seen it in like garden centres, mm-hmm. as fountains. Very odd.
It's Brussels, isn't it? The famous modern example.
Ah, is that where it is? Yeah. Okay. Oh, that reminds me of another thing I found out during my research. The Trevi Fountain in Rome, the very, very famous one, that's still supplied from like an ancient aqueduct.
Nice. That's
really? So is there still quite a lot of Roman infrastructure that's still being used then?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that all the Roman infrastructure is still there. No, in the sense that it's also been adapted and built over. So, it depends how you want to classify it as Roman. If you want to say sort of like, oh, the original idea, the original pipeline for that, yep, the Romans laid that, but the actual pipe work itself is not necessarily Roman, which is a good thing because they lined all their pipes with lead and that's poisonous.
Yeah, that's true. I like to avoid lead poisoning where I can. So we've talked a bit about Happy, the blue dude with the boobs, and we've talked about Minerva Sulis. Are there any other water deities that we need to talk about, that we need to bring to the forefront of our attention today?
Well, if you want a water deity that combines that sort of the watery theme but also the etymology thing, I can briefly tell you about Oceanus, or Oceanos as he is actually called, which is just, I think this is really interesting, you can see how it's happened, but that's the river god, ocean, for the ancient Greeks. I know, it's so random. He's like this great, so the ocean, the word ocean that we have comes from, I think it goes through Latin, but ultimately from Oceanus. Like, I'm saying it really weirdly to sort of show you how it's got there. And that's, he's this like great earth encircling river. And that's the instead of mythological thought, this god river. Again, he's sort of one of these interesting, like the Greeks do this a lot, where they're sort of simultaneously a god, but also a natural force. And that word could be used to describe the god in a kind of personified sense, but also just the thing itself, the river. And in mythological thought, as I say, they thought that this was the source of all the fresh water in the world, Oceanus or Oceanus, which I just think is so random. And now we've now started using that to mean completely the opposite. But I assume it just went through some kind of, you know, movement from river to water to ocean.
Is it not that the sea at large that, you know, surrounds, well, all continents, was like the river of Oceanus?
Yeah, but then they do also have like Poseidon, who's the sea god, and that's quite distinct. So yeah, it could be that they're like there's a big sea, which is also the river. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go over to Barney now. Any more water deities from you?
Yeah. So there's a god of water in the ancient Near East, whose Sumerian name is Enki. And his Akkadian name is Ea, E-A. And Ea is the god of wisdom as well as water. And he sort of, imparts knowledge to mankind. And he lives down in the Apsu, which is the sort of primordial waters that exist at the start of creation. Got a nice house there. But what I love most about Ea is how he's depicted in art and representations. So pretty classic Mesopotamian look, nice beard, big pointy hat, which all the deities have. But the thing that's unique to Ea is that water streams out of his shoulders like wings, and often in those sort of watery wings are fish swimming along the streams that emanate from his body.
That's so cool. What a fashion statement that is.
You know, it's not a patch on Jesus, right? If you're just walking around and just fish are just flowing out of your body.
Right? That's so camp. That is very Met Gala.
That is so camp. That's great.
I wonder if he can control, like, the species of fish.
Mm. Oh, here you go. Here's, like, prime salmon.
It's like a soda stream.
Yeah, so just true. You just put the Pepsi one in, and like, I wonder where it goes. But yeah, no, it'd be quite annoying if he's walking around and just like mackerel was coming out. It's quite gross, but you know,
anchovies.
But yeah, if he's walking around and like some like delightful sea bass.
Oh yeah,
pan fried.
Exactly, pre-pan fried. Coming out of his armpits. But we like Ea, and he's generally a helpful deity to humankind. And it's him who advises the flood survivor, Utnapishtim, how to survive the flood in that flood cycle of myths that is represented in part in the Epic of Gilgamesh. So, yeah, good guy, Ea, Enki.
I was promised some etymology, and I would like some etymology ASAP.
Oh, okay. Well, okay, we can stick with Barney for now then. It's a good watery etymology. So earlier I was talking about irrigation canals, and I thought therefore I would deliver you the surprising etymology of the word canal. Because, you know, I think canal, pretty familiar word. So you'd probably be quite surprised to hear that it has potentially Sumerian roots.
Ooh.
What?
I was going to say Canaanite, but no.
I would just have assumed Latin, like cannelloni in Italian.
Yep, yeah, it's honestly, like, it's a really long etymology.
Okay, I'm seated and listening.
Here we go. So we get canal in English from canal in French, which is, you know, a water channel. And that comes from Latin, canalis, which is pipe or a channel as well, which is apparently from the Latin word for reed, which is canna, you know, through like an analogy of, you know, a reed is a sort of like a very small pipe. Yeah, it has like a hole through the middle of it. So yeah, we get our word cane from that, canna as well. And canna in Latin came from Greek canna, which potentially was borrowed from Akkadian canu, which is spelled with a Q, which is their word for reed. Which ultimately derives from Sumerian. So yeah, well, that's pretty nuts.
That's huge.
Yeah,
that's genuinely one of our best.
What I like about the canal etymology there, though, is that despite the fact that our friends in the ancient Near East really loved a canal, the sense of our word channel, meaning an artificial waterway, actually developed quite late. And so despite the fact that our word for canal can be traced all the way back to Sumerian, it only really came to mean, like, you know, a man-made water management system a few hundred years ago.
Channel is from the same root, right?
That's right, yeah. It's a doublet, linguistic doublet.
Beautiful.
Two borrowings from the same source.
Stunning. I like also, this is super vague and abstract, it's a slightly meta etymology. A metamology, if you will, where like the thing we're describing is a kind of a thing that brings one thing from to another. Like we talk about language trees, but I feel like you could also have a language canal network to describe the process that you just have described.
Yes, I love it. Guiding meaning through history.
The aqueduct of meaning. Oh, that's good.
It's another PhD.
Oh God, another one.
Meg, you mentioned Athens earlier. Is there any other ancient Greek places where water plays a big role?
Yeah, so I was having quite a detailed look at the Minoans, actually, who I've spoken about before, and this is interesting. They're not just a different place, they're also a different time period. So the Minoans, one of the early Greek civilizations, which were before the Bronze Age collapse in about 1200 BC. So this is before Athens is a big deal, before any of that. And they are just absolutely slaying the sort of hydro technology field. Not literally the field, but also they were slaying in terms of the field. I think I mentioned in our toilet episode, they have possibly the first flushing toilet, which is basically like a kind of weight distribution system to move water around to create a sort of semi-flushing toilet, which is pretty cool. Like you look at it and you're like, would we call that flushing? But actually pretty sick given how early we're talking. And they just like, they have really cool early water transportation, draining, good like gutters, really, really into their gutters. So like these quite nice street organizations. This is all like Crete, basically, what's now Crete, the cities there. have good organisation of the cities, including these gutters at the edges of all of the roads and kind of going up any steps, going alongside the steps, so you get a good flow of water out, but also a good flow of water in. They've got some nice aqueducts, some of which are like the like just using gravity, like Xenia was talking about a bit earlier, but also some which have a kind of pressurisation system. Water coming from the like foothills of mountains 10 kilometers away. And also, I couldn't really work out whether this is true, couldn't get a good source for this, but they apparently had water filtration systems. So they used sand and charcoal to filter the water that they collected from rainwater, which was used for lots of things. And charcoal is apparently still used for like filtration, basically. Take that with a pinch of salt, pinch of charcoal, if you will. I couldn't find like detailed sources for that, but that was mentioned in a couple of articles, that they had these sort of cisterns, which are basically like, if you imagine, yeah, sort of water purification plant nowadays, I think is what we'd call it, like multiple different cisterns with different like stages of water being kind of going through and filtered. So I just thought that was really cool. And they're just doing a great job early on. So just a bit of a, you know, four for you, Minoa, Crete.
Great job, Minoans. And is that where Minotaur or Minotaur comes from?
Yes, exactly. So King Minos of what's now Crete built a labyrinth. So that's where we get Minos, and then Tor is bull. So the Minos Tor.
Amaze balls.
When people talk about like the great aqueducts of Rome and these ingenious like water management systems in Minoan Crete, I think sometimes the ancient Near East can get overlooked when we're thinking about big public works to do with water. You know, there's a lot of small scale fundamental stuff like irrigation, but not necessarily the massive fountains and baths and aqueducts of Rome or any of these big water management systems that you see in cities in Minoan Greece, for example. But one of the most famous examples of water management is it's the Hanging Gardens, you know, the wonder of the world. They were the Hanging Gardens of Flo. Can you remember Hanging Gardens of
Babylon?
No.
Is that against the law?
Dun, dun, dun.
Is that it was like, such a good intro.
Is it the Hanging Gardens of like Swindon or something? And we've got it really badly wrong.
Yes, it's the Hanging Gardens of Milton Keynes.
Oh my goodness.
I did have good town planning.
So yeah, so one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, as described by Greek writers, was the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. But a few years ago, an Assyriologist called Stephanie Daly published her theory that the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, which have never been identified in the archaeological record as being in Babylon, may actually have been in the Assyrian city of Nineveh, and were in fact the palace of King Sennacherib of the Neo-Assyrian Empire. Which is a pretty cool theory because, you know, there are wonders from amongst those seven which either still stand today or we know, you know, pretty much exactly where they stood, like the Pharos Lighthouse at Alexandria, for example, and the Colossus of Rhodes. You know, these can be well placed even though they don't still exist. And obviously the pyramids are there. But the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, complete mystery. But yeah, I think a pretty compelling theory from Professor Daly is that, yeah, they were in fact in Assyria. The idea being that they were his palace, which had a brilliant system of gardens within it where water was brought in from the outside with aqueducts and used to create this incredible paradise, basically, with, you know, plants hanging over the walls and raised up on high, as well as growing from the ground level. And, you know, it was quite common for Assyrian kings to cultivate sort of menageries and zoos. So you'd have, you know, animals wandering through in certain zones and just creating this incredibly beautiful idyll, basically, with, you know, loads of plant life and greenery in the middle of the steppe and the rocky landscapes of northern Iraq.
Honestly, babe, it sounds gorge.
Holiday when?
Against the law group trip. Did you say Nineveh, Barney?
Yeah.
Isn't that where they found the Gilgamesh tablets?
Yeah, in Ashurbanipal's library.
Ashurbanipal's library, no way. Yes, amazing. Yes, you could go to the beautiful Hanging Gardens on your honeymoon and read the tablets on your Kindle.
Exactly.
Yeah, if you're a massive nerd.
Okay.
What else would people be doing on their honeymoon, Flo?
I didn't get a honeymoon because of the pandemic, Barney, so I don't know.
Oh.
But if I had my way, we would have gone to the Hanging Gardens of Swindon.
I guess, has anyone been to the Barbican Conservatory?
I've been thinking that for the entire time you've been talking. I didn't want to jump in and be like, is it like the Barbican? But yes, that's exactly what I picture when anyone ever says the Hanging Gardens of Babylon.
I think that's probably a good way of thinking about it. Like big, clearly artificial structure, but with plant life sort of at heights that might surprise you.
That's such
all right,
a relative...
advertising team for the Barbican.
I just feel like it just depends what surprises you, really. Like, that's great.
1 meter? No. 4, maybe. So yeah, so these hanging gardens may be more likely the palace of some of the greatest despots ever to rule the ancient Near East, and all made possible by a complex system of aqueducts and irrigation throughout the palace. So, you know, water management at the core of all my favourite things, including one of the Seven Wonders.
That's hella cute. Thanks, Barney. So I think it's time to put the cork in the water bottle of this episode and think about what our favourite things have been. First off, I'm going to start with you, Barney. What was your favourite thing from today?
My favourite thing was Xenia's explanation of syncretism, the mashing together of two different gods in the context of Bath. No, something about culture clash and multiculturalism always gets me. So yeah, that was nice to hear how that applied to the one city of Bath and its wonderful baths. Thank you, Xenia.
How gorgeous it is. Xenia, I'm going to come over to you next. What was your favourite thing?
Oh, well, right back at Barney, I loved hearing about Happy and who was the extremely fabulous god with water coming out of his shoulders?
Ea or Enki.
Enki, let's just, like, honestly, the Mesopotamian gods, like, blow my mind. Sorry, I know Happy's Egyptian. Ancient Near Eastern gods, they blow my mind. They're just so cool. The imagination is so fantastic. Like, they feel like they have so much presence and gorgeousness. I love it.
Very, very camp. Meg, that's not a description for you. I'm just coming to you next. What was your favourite thing from today?
Thanks, Flo. Yeah, I completely agree with Xenia. I was just thinking the same. Like, I think Barney's gods, they're not your gods, Barney's. none of us make sense today. The ancient Near Eastern gods, I guess almost because some of them are less familiar to us than the Greco-Roman pantheon, are just so exciting to hear about. So I absolutely love that. But I am obviously going to say the etymology of canal was my favourite thing from today.
My favourite thing from today was also an etymology, and it was against the law etymology, and it's yours, Meg. I really liked that. The word ocean actually didn't have its origins where you'd think. I enjoyed that immensely. I've enjoyed all the word meanings today. And do you know what? I'm quite thirsty now after all that talking. So let's bring this episode to a close and you can join us next time for Against the Law. If you've enjoyed today's episode, you can always choose to support us on Patreon.
We've got all sorts of tiers for every budget, starting from just £3 a month. Benefits include getting each episode a day early, stickers, and your name in cuneiform.
You can find us on Twitter at Against Law, and you can also find us on TikTok at Against the Law Podcast.
We're also always happy to hear suggestions, questions about the podcast, and other requests. If you want to email us, our email is againstthelawpodcast@gmail.com.